Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 160. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around we are completing something I started a long time ago on the podcast, and that is the Harry Palmer trilogy starring Michael Caine from the middle 1960s. We're going with the first of the three, The Ypres File, and then we are going to the third of the three, which is The Billion Dollar Brain, directed by Ken Russell. I've done the second one of the trilogy, which was Funeral in Berlin, a long time ago on Paleo Cinema Podcast. So I thought I'd just complete things and tick that box and then move on. So we're looking at middle 1960s, Euro spy, Brit spy stuff. By the way, the music for this podcast, this particular track, is called Local Forecast. It's by Ken McLeod, and it is released on a Creative Commons 3.0 attribution license. So sit back, relax, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we'll start talking about alternative spy movies from the 1960s. Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast of classic movie appreciation. There are only two rules to the podcast. The first one is that I have to like the film, or it's been suggested by a Patreon subscriber. The other rule is that it has to be at least 20 years old. So none of this new stuff, it's all old, it's all good. So if you want to contact me, you can email at cultguru@gmail.com, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U. @gmail.com, or else you can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can also go to paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. Now, there occasionally are adult themes and adult language used in this podcast. Just be aware of that as well. You can also leave reviews on iTunes, so if you're so inclined, please do so. It would help the podcast out a lot. So sit back, relax now, and we'll get on with the show. And thank you for listening. Hi, how's everybody going? Yesterday we had a really interesting day. Sal and I went out to a town called Clunes, which is about 100 kilometres away, because it's Australia's first book town, and they're having their annual book festival. So we went in there. Basically, the whole main street of the town gets blocked off and turned into an enormous bookshop with cafes and things as well. Even the real estate agent got turned into a bookshop. A pharmacy got turned into a bookshop. Everything gets turned into a bookshop. So you're paying $10, you go in there, and they have tons and tons of old and new books. So I did drop a few bucks there, I'll be honest with you. I picked up a couple of movie-related classic books, which you can see on my Facebook page. I picked up some magazines. I even picked up a Daybill poster for a 1960s Eurospy spoof called Bonditis, which I've been looking at getting a copy of for a while. They actually had some Daybill movie posters there, so I was quite pleased with that. I did catch up with a couple of authors I know, Narelle Harris, who has been on Martian Drive-In podcast in the past, and Jane Routley, a couple of authors that I know, who were there to flog their wares. So we did that, and then we went off to another town called Creswick, which you might be interested to know was the town featured in the recent telemovie remake of Salem's Lot. They filmed it here in Australia, and they filmed it in Creswick. So we went there, found a really nice French cafe, and had some croque monsieurs and some coffees and things like that, and then we came home. So it was a pretty good day, and I picked up some movie-related stuff. One of those anthologies of horror stories that Alfred Hitchcock curated in the 1950s. I got one of those. Picked up the book upon which the Small Back Room, a very fine British movie from the 1940s, was based. The Ill-Shaped Room, another one, which is another British movie. I got the book based on that, and a few other things, and including, oddly enough, this is a serendipitous discovery, I found a biography of Step and Fetch It, which was kind of cool, and I'm looking forward to reading that as well. So yeah, it's very literary kind of day. They had young women, actors I think they were, who were wander around the town square doing soliloquies and things like that from Shakespeare while standing on little black boxes, and doing duets and all sorts of things like that. They had a juggler and a magician doing street magic for children, They had a brass band. It was just a very, very cool day. I really enjoyed that a lot, just hanging out and doing the literary thing. So Clunes, and even when it isn't being like the major festival book town, it's still a book town. So it's worth, if you get to Melbourne, it's worth taking the trip out to Clunes and checking out all the bookstores there. I picked up a few nice things only a few weeks ago when Sal and I visited there. But so the movie reference library here has just got that little bit bigger. I really should post on Facebook a some pictures of the movie reference books that I've got here for Paleo Cinema and for Martian Drive-In Podcast, just to show you the kind of stuff that I use to glean some of the information for the podcast. That Speed It Up fanfare, of course, tells you that it's time for the stuff that I've been watching, the movies I've been watching lately. Let's see. From about 1994, rewatched The Shadow, the Russell Mulcahy version of The Shadow, you know, Lamont Cranston, Clouding Men's Minds, all that kind of thing, which starred Alec Baldwin, Penelope Ann Miller, John Lone, and Tim Curry. Kind of like it. It's got Ian McKellen in it as well, in a very thankless role. But I kind of like it. It's a very 1940s/1930s maybe movie. It's got some really weird casting in it. Jonathan Winters playing the police commissioner is kind of cool. And I think it's a failed but interesting attempt. They do some innovative for the time computer effects to convey magic, which I kind of liked. And it's one of those movies that I'd like to be a bit better than it is, but I still kind of enjoy it when I watch it. Then I went retro and wanted to check out a Jacques Tourneur movie, which got name-checked at one stage. It's a movie that is kind of rare and doesn't get mentioned much when people talk about his oeuvre, and that's Experiment Perilous, starring Hedy Lamarr and George Brent, which is kind of a little bit of a gothic potboiler, in a sense, with a psychotic husband and a wife, a beautiful wife who's under his spell, and a doctor who gets involved with things. And yeah, it's not a bad little movie. Very strange. I'm going to have to watch it one more time, I think, just to kind of see how much I like it. And I may well put it into a future podcast. It's interesting enough to do that, but I really want to kind of watch it when I'm a little more awake than I was when I watched it this time, and just evaluate it. Now, what did my ongoing thing of watching different adaptations of The Merry Widow, the musical based on the Franz Lehár operetta, and this time I saw one that was kind of miscast in an interesting way. It's from the early 1950s. It's The Merry Widow, starring Fernando Lamas as Daniil, the gigolo kind of soldier, and Lana Turner playing the Merry Widow. And yeah, it's an MGM musical, but I think it's a little bit stiff and a little bit strange for that. But like I said, I was just going through different versions of it, so I thought I'd watch that. I still like some of the songs, and Fernando Lamas, really interesting looking actor, because I think he's got an enormous head. So I watched that, and then there was a suggestion for the ABC radio gig from one of our listeners who suggested that we do Pink Floyd's The Wall. Now, I hadn't seen Pink Floyd's The Wall, which was directed by Alan Parker. I've forgotten, but it's Alan Parker, starring, of course, Bob Geldof. It's also got Bob Hoskins in a very thankless role in it. It's all based on that kind of rock opera, The Wall, and I've decided that it's a piece of shit. Really, Bob Geldof could not act his way out of a parking ticket. Really, it was pretty fucking awful. Didn't particularly like the songs. You know, Pink Floyd's not my thing, and I got a couple of people get a bit shitty with me on Facebook for saying that. Too bad. I don't have to like it. I can like Franz Lehár's The Merry Widow instead if I want to. But we had a chat about that. I know Liz liked it a bit more than I did, but I got some good feedback from program management, ABC management, that they loved what we did there when we disagreed, but we did it in a very cordial and friendly way and kind of dissected the movie in an interesting manner. So that was kind of I thought it was going to be a failure because we disagreed about it, but the rapport that Liz and I are growing between us kind of worked. And I liked that. I really enjoyed the rapport, but I didn't enjoy the movie. Now, I saw a documentary called Trumbo about Dalton Trumbo, one of the blacklisted writers, screenwriters from the 1950s. They have a lot of famous actors reading stuff from Trumbo's diaries and letters, which made it interesting. Donald Sutherland is particularly good when he does that. They had Michael Douglas doing it as well, and a bunch of other people. Liam Neeson as well. So they kind of illustrated some of the writings of Trumbo as well as his career. There's some home movies and some other things just to talk about his life and his career. If you haven't looked at Dalton Trumbo's IMDb page, you'd be amazed at the amount of stuff he did, even while he was blacklisted, but the amount of stuff he did in his own name as well. So that was interesting. I always like a good documentary about people involved in the movie making process. And then I got into the movies that I picked up on Blu-ray as a part of my birthday stuff. So Sal gave me some money and said go and piss it away on Amazon on movies, so I did. So I saw a couple of movies from that, actually three. First one I saw was The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, a Billy Wilder adaptation of the Conan Doyle character, but taking it into a slightly different direction, starring Robert Stevens and Colin Blakely. And yeah, I like it pretty much. It's got something really interesting, which I should mention. Christopher Lee with his real unadulterated baldness. Now, Christopher Lee didn't wear a rug for this movie, and I think he's got a good shaped head. I don't know why he went back to wearing rugs, but in this one, he's got his natural baldness showing, playing Mycroft Holmes. And he does a very good job of it, as indeed does Robert Stevens, Colin Blakely, Genevieve Page playing the femme fatale. And it's quite a cool little story. And the other interesting thing about that is there are some extras. There are some missing scenes that they've kind of recreated using scripts and stills and some of the audio from them, which would have made the movie a lot more interesting had they retained them. But, you know, what studios were like in the 1960s. They didn't know when they had a good thing. Then I'd watched a French action film from the 1960s that I hadn't seen before. It's called Up to His Ears, starring Jean-Paul Belmondo and Ursula Andress. And it was directed by Philippe de Broca, who directed L'Homme de Rio, which I mentioned in a previous podcast, That Man from Rio. And Belmondo, it's basically a silly thing. He plays a really kind of bored and jaded millionaire who decides that there's nothing interesting in life. And he decides to arrange for his Chinese friend, Mr. Go, to arrange for him to be killed because he's bored with life and he can't commit suicide successfully. And he's full of ennui and he's got an emo fringe at the front of his hair. And then he falls in love with Ursula Andress, who's playing a stripper. And who wouldn't? And then discovers that he wants to live and decides to chase Mr. Go to get him to stop the assassins from killing him. And Mr. Go has gone to a retreat in Tibet. In Nepal, sorry. And so he goes from Hong Kong to Nepal. Now, Nepal, of course, is in the news at the moment because of those horrible earthquakes. But it's really interesting seeing A, Hong Kong in the mid-1960s, and Kathmandu. There weren't many Western films filming in Kathmandu at the time. But this one does, and it's got some beautiful mountain landscapes. It's got the usual Philippe de Broca / Jean-Paul Belmondo stunt work, which is spectacularly good. Belmondo did a lot of his own stunts. If you haven't seen Belmondo in the tip-up truck in a movie called The Burglars, you really should see that because he does a stunt there that's fucking insane. But I really enjoyed the film. It's kind of very silly. It gets slapsticky and cartoony at times, but it's got a few nice conceits in it. And, I had it in a double Blu-ray pack with a Blu-ray copy of L'Homme de Rio. So I'm going to rewatch L'Homme de Rio at some stage because it's a movie from which Steven Spielberg and George Lucas pinched a lot of stuff from for the Indiana Jones movies. And like I've said before in the podcast, it's always good to go back to primary sources on things. Then I watched another movie I got on Blu-ray, Kiss Me, Kate, starring Howard Keel, Catherine Grayson, Ann Miller. It's got Ron Randell, an Australian actor, playing Cole Porter. And then it's got that fantastic dancing. It's a Cole Porter musical. It's got that fantastic dancing by people like Bobby Van and Bob Fosse and John Rolle. It's just an old favourite of mine. I've actually got the Blu-ray version, which has also the 3D version of this film, because it was originally designed to be in 3D. Though I don't have a 3D television, so I haven't been able to access that part. What I might do is see who I know has got a 3D television and a 3D Blu-ray player that does multi-zone, because I've got this is the American zoning one, and see if I can sit down and watch Kiss Me, Kate in 3D, because that'd be a lot of fun to do. So I watched that. Then I watched a recent spy movie, which is the thing that led me on to rewatching Ipcress File and Billion Dollar Brain. That's Kingsman: The Secret Service, with Colin Firth in it and Michael Caine, of course. I kind of like that. I like the Mark Millar adaptations of the graphic novels, and this one stays fairly true with a few variations to the graphic novel. It's got Samuel L. Jackson as a lisping, evil billionaire technology dude, and he has just the right tone for this kind of movie. It's over the top, it's silly, it's incredibly gory and nasty in parts, which freaked out a few of the people I know that have seen the film, but that kind of stuff doesn't really faze me when it's done so elegantly as it is in this one. But I enjoyed that one, and that's about it for the stuff I've been watching. So I'm going to take a break now. When we get back, we're going to talk about the first of the three Harry Palmer movies from 1965, and it is the Ipcress File, which also stars Guy Dolman, Sue Lloyd, and Nigel Green.
Someone is trying to frame me. You've got to help me.
But you're just too hot, Palmer.
Follow Harry Palmer. What happens to him concerns you. Yes, you. And you.
Forget all about the Ipcress File.
You have forgotten your name.
In truth, his name is Michael Caine, and no one will forget his name. Michael Caine. He walks straight into sensational stardom in the Ipcress File as he gets right under the skin of the brash, cocky, wry-humored Harry Palmer. The soldier seconded from the army for security duties, who's never far away from a girl, and always closer than close to trouble.
Now get this. I'm going to tell you until I know you're clean. And if you're not clean, I'm going to kill you.
Both these men cover the British security network, but each keeps his own counsel and his own secrets. The one on the left is Dolby of the Home Office, a passed-over major, but nothing passes him by now.
A word in your shell-like ear. If there's anything to be reported to Ross, I report it. Understand?
Yes, sir.
This is Colonel Ross of the War Office.
I want you to do a job for me.
Any choice?
Frankly, no.
She's Jean Courtney, one of the agents Harry works alongside. But whose side is she on?
You're working for Ross. He sent you here.
Don't be silly. I'm working for Dolby.
Between the kisses and the double crosses, they are all working for somebody, whilst you get the closest workover of them all as you actively share the stark, dangerous secrets of the Ipcress File. Move over for today's most sensational hypnotic meeting with suspense.
That was the trailer for the 1965 British spy movie, The Ipcress File, starring Michael Caine, because we've always got to say it that way at least once during the podcast, Guy Dolman, Nigel Green, and Sue Lloyd. Now, this was designed specifically to be an anti-James Bond film, which is kind of funny in a way because one of the producers of this film, Harry Saltzman, was also one of the two producers for the James Bond movies at the time. So Harry Palmer was designed right from the get-go to be a good quality spy movie, but very kind of non-Bond. There are a lot of things that give that away, of course. A lot of the people involved in the film were very much outliers rather than mainstream people from the British film industry and from British society itself. Let's take a look at that a little bit. You'd have to start with Harry Palmer, the character himself, as played by Michael Caine in this movie, which is just as his career started really taking off. He's a working-class Cockney guy, working for a couple of bosses who are very much upper-class establishment guys who have clubs. In fact, one of the two guys, Ross, invites Dorby, the other guy, to have lunch at his club where the Dover Sole is very good. And so there's that dynamic set up in this film that basically Harry Palmer does the dirty work for the aristocracy and for the rich guys and for the people in power very much, which again is something that James Bond does, and the contrast between the two is quite important. James Bond does that, but James Bond is of the upper class. James Bond does get the posh hotels. He does get the posh women. He does get to travel a lot more than Harry Palmer does. The places where Harry Palmer travels to in the three movies, The Ipcress File, Funeral in Berlin, and Billion Dollar Brain, aren't the best places in the world. I'll go into that a little more when I'm talking about Billion Dollar Brain. But basically, he's there, he wears an overcoat, he's got NHS glasses. He's an aspirational character, though, and you see that right at the start when he wakes up. In the opening montage, we learn a fair bit about Harry Palmer as a human being and as a character in some very interesting ways. He's got a very neat apartment. He wears glasses, which is a very un-James Bond thing. He has a neat kitchen. He has Len Deighton's cooking columns from the newspaper. Len Deighton, the writer of the book, The Ipcress File. He did a cooking column for one of the English newspapers, and some of his newspaper columns are hanging up in Harry's kitchen. At the time when most Englishmen were drinking tea, or instant coffee at best, you do see Harry grinding coffee beans and then putting them into a French press plunger, which at the time was a really unusual thing to do because plunger coffee didn't really hit big until the 1990s. But Harry Palmer's way ahead of the curve there. Yeah, he's a gourmet chef, but he does shop in supermarkets, as one of his encounters with Ross tells us. Then we learn a couple of other things in that early montage about Harry as well. He finds a lady's bracelet in his bed. He realizes that he's woken up alone and the woman's left. So we know that he's sexually heterosexual. And we also learn that he brings women home sometimes. So he's not an unsuccessful heterosexual in that sense. So you get some similarities with Bond, but you also get them in a more prosaic kind of form in the way Harry is. Then in his initial chat with Ross, we learn that he earns 1,300 quid a year, and he's trying to get 1,400. Now, one of the things about the James Bond films that's really obvious is James Bond doesn't need to worry about money, even in the early James Bond films. His wage is never discussed. He has the best of everything when he's travelling on assignment. But Harry Palmer is very much living in a different world where budgets and a few pounds here and there really matter. It's a world closer to the world of the characters in The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, the one played by Richard Burton in particular, which I've talked about in a previous podcast. It's very much a kind of gritty, rainy, dark and dank London that we see in Harry Palmer's world. Now, the director as well is an outlier, Sidney J. Fury, who's an American director who did a lot of work in England. He started out doing some not quite as prestigious movies like Dr. Blood's Coffin in 1961, The Snake Woman in 1962. He directed The Young Ones, the Cliff Richard musical, as well as the third of the Cliff Richard musicals, which were very popular in England in the early 1960s, and which was Wonderful Life, which I kind of like both of them, both The Young Ones and Wonderful Life, even though I'm not particularly fond of Cliff Richard. I like the energy and the vitality and the fun of those movies, which is partly due to the enthusiasm that Sidney J. Fury puts into things. He went on to do a number of other films after The Ipcress Files. He did The Naked Runner for Frank Sinatra in 1967, Little Falls and Big Halsey in 1970, which is a movie I remember seeing in the cinemas way back in the day, Lady Sings the Blues, which is the story of Billie Holiday, starring Diana Ross, Gable and Lombard, which is a story, of course, of Clark Gable and Carol Lombard. He did the horrible and nasty and not quite cool Superman 4 Quest for Peace. So, you know, there's a downside to his career here. He did some Iron Eagle movies, which were kind of like wannabe faux Top Gun films. And he's still working as a director. He did a thing called The Dependables in 2014. I'm just clicking on that to see what that is. So, you know, he's still kind of out there directing. The Dependables, let's see, it's about a whole bunch. Five young American soldiers are held hostage in Afghanistan by a Taliban warlord. When the US is slow to act, a grandmother and four grandfathers with military background in Afghanistan fly to rescue them. I'm going to watch that. I am going to have to see that movie. It's got Lou Gossett Jr., Margot Kidder, Seymour Cassell, Bo Svenson in it. I think I'm going to have to look at The Dependables because it's kind of like a really slightly older than Sylvester Stallone version of The Dependables. So Sidney J. Fury wasn't really a mainstream director at the time, but I love the directing he does in The Ipcress Files, because if you watch the direction really closely, there's a lot of kind of Dutch angles and there's a lot of things shot from the ground up. The whole movie is, and a lot of things shot through car doors and from surreptitious locations where people are travelling through London. So all of it's got this feeling of being covert and the feeling of you, the audience, is watching from cover, in a sense. And that's kind of cool and interesting. It does draw attention to itself after a certain time, but the way Sidney J. Fury does it does kind of give you a feeling of tradecraft, that kind of skill set that a spy has. It gives you a lot of that kind of stuff. It is a little bit mannered, a little bit stylized, but I think for the subject matter it does kind of work, and it also differentiates the films very much from the Bond films, in that the Bond films are a lot more traditionally directed. I probably should talk about the story of the film, but just to keep going with the outliers, the soundtrack by John Barry is kind of interesting as well, in the fact that he uses a cymbalom, which is a kind of Hungarian dulcimer, as the main instrument in there. So it's got that slightly strange feeling about it. And then there's that spooky sound you heard on the trailer, which is the Ipcress process itself, which is a form of brainwashing using some very fucked up techniques that kind of had a little bit in common with the MK Ultra mind fuck stuff that the CIA were actually doing in the late 1950s. It's all to do with sleep deprivation, loud noises, and repetition of instruction, which very much were a part of the spy scene at the time, dating back as far as the Manchurian Candidate in 1962. Which, in a sense, is a spy movie, though it tends to be about mind-fucking soldiers. But there is a covert and spy aspect to The Manchurian Candidate. Then you've got the dynamic and the bureaucracy of Harry Palmer's spy world, with the paperwork and all of the obscure names for paperwork that they have in both Ross and Dorby's organisations, or aspects of the British intelligence organisation. And you get the kind of power plays between Ross and Dorby, which are a little bit bureaucratic, but also they have a sinister edge as well. There's always that awareness that what they're doing is very, very dangerous stuff, and very, if they fuck up, there can be enormous consequences. So you keep getting that theme running through things, particularly when some of Dolby's men start dying while they're on surveillance. Then, of course, you've got the love interest in this film, which is not quite a love interest. It's more like a mutual in-bed surveillance thing between Jean, the character played by Sue Lloyd, and Harry. And they're both aware that they might not be exactly what they seem. In Jean's case, without doing spoilers, is slightly true. And the rule of thumb here, of course, is don't sleep with anybody who was involved in the espionage trade at all, because it won't end well for you, as we also demonstrate again in both Funeral in Berlin and in Billion Dollar Brain. But Sidney J. Fury's direction was very modern at the time, and the real-life locations work well. There's a scene where the man that Harry is trailing has a bodyguard whose code name is House Martin, and we see a fight between him and Harry on the steps behind the Albert Hall, which is filmed through the door of a car. And that's an interesting choice, too. The actual fight scenes aren't framed as fight scenes. They're framed as fight scenes that you're watching from cover. And that makes things slightly different, except right at the end where things get a bit more traditionally action-oriented, as Harry is kidnapped and undergoes the Ypres process and tries to plan his escapes. And those bits of the film are interesting as well, but that brings me to the point where I've really got to talk about the plot rather than just the things that differentiate this from the Bond films. Basically, Harry Palmer has moved from one department to the other to work for Dalby, who is working on a problem that the English have with a brain drain. All their top scientists are disappearing, with the exception in this case of Professor Radcliffe, who is kidnapped, and then they buy him back from the kidnappers. And he suddenly undergoes a traumatic, catatonic kind of amnesia. So he can't work as a physicist anymore. He's a very important physicist who's working on proton, something or other. And the intermediary who negotiates returning Professor Radcliffe to the British Secret Service is a character called Grantby, whose codename is Blue Jay. And we soon learn eventually that there is a process called IPCRES, which stands for, and this isn't too much of a spoil, Induction of Psychoneuroses by Conditioned Reflex Under Stress. It's a kind of contraction of that, which is kind of cool, but also kind of sinister as well. And this, again, is one of the interesting things I find, because while James Bond is very flashy with his tradecraft and his spy guy skills, you see Harry Palmer using his brain to a larger extent than Bond did in these films, in the early films. Bond is very much a kind of elite athlete spy, whereas Harry Palmer is the one who knows his stuff. When they try to track down Grantby, Harry goes lateral rather than going through a list of names he's given to try to find out which one knows where Grantby is. He goes and hooks up with some friends he knows at the Metropolitan Police, finds out whether Grantby's got any parking tickets, where the parking tickets were given out, and whether there's any consistency there, which is how he traces Grantby to the parking spot behind Albert Hall. So he uses his brain and uses some kind of detection skills and investigative skills to find what he needs to find. And that is a nice thing. It's a kind of halfway point between a police procedural and a spy movie, using the strengths of both of those genres in a lot of ways. And then when Harry is kidnapped and transported to Albania and undergoes the Ypres process, you see him again using skills that he knows, which is how to resist interrogation. They have a kind of almost montage scenes showing the 2 weeks he's in prison and the ways that food is given to him and then taken away from him, the deprivation of food, the sleep deprivation, the using cold as a means of breaking down his resistance, and the ways he uses to combat both that particular kind of breaking down process and then the Ypres process itself and the mind-fucking that goes along with that, the mind-washing, the mind-fucking that goes along with that. And that's kind of cool. You can't really do a spy movie without that, some level of that kind of sadism against the protagonist. And this movie doesn't shy away from that. It really doesn't. Of course, it turns out that there is a double agent there and that Harry escapes and he has a three-way confrontation with his two bosses and himself while he's still right after the interrogation, right after his escape from the interrogation, where his mind's confused, he's utterly exhausted, he's got a gun holding them on both of the bosses, and things have to play out where the double agent doesn't quite know whether the conditioning has worked on Harry or not, and how is he going to play things out, because this is being from an era where there were some very kind of downbeat, depressing and negative spy movies, and this movie does have a lot in common in some aspects with The Spy That Came In From a Cold, which doesn't have a good ending, and ultimately the resolution plays out. Of course, The Ipcress File wasn't as popular as the James Bond movies were at the time, but it did a really nice bunch of money on it. Of course, it got two direct sequels, and then two sequels in the 1990s. There were two more movies made starring Harry Palmer that were made for television in the 1990s by Harry Alan Towers. You got Bullet to Beijing and Midnight in St. Petersburg, which were made back-to-back in 1995, and one was released in 95, one was released in 96. They're lower budget, they show a much older Harry Palmer, and the post-Cold War era Soviet Union in a lot of ways. But really, I watched Bullet to Beijing today, and avoid it if you can. I watched it so you don't have to. Unless you want to be a completist with the story of Harry Palmer, I recommend that you avoid Midnight in St. Petersburg and Bullet to Beijing. They really are lesser works, and the character goes through some changes which aren't consistent with the character we know from the three movies in the 1960s. Michael Caine has said that those two movies, Bullet to Beijing and Midnight in St. Petersburg, were among the most unhappy professional experiences he had in his life. And after making them, he was seriously contemplating leaving the acting profession and retiring. Now, we wouldn't have had the 20 years of movies we've had since from Michael Caine, should that have occurred. But that shows you just what kind of shit he went through. They filmed him in Russia. The Russian mafia were making threats against him, and he had to have bodyguards all the time. And also, he was working on a pair of movies which just simply aren't that good. But that's about it for The Ipcress File, a classic of 1960s spy cinema. So I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, we're going to talk about the craziness and the over-the-top techno fetishism, almost, of Billion Dollar Brain.
Yes?
Is that Palmer, private detective of London, speaking? Yes or no?
Who wants him?
Is that Palmer, private detective of London. Confirmed.
Yes.
You have received a key and £200. Confirmed.
Who is this?
You have received a key and £200. Confirmed.
Yes.
Mr. Palmer, you will deliver a package. Confirmed.
Yes, but who is this?
Saw him Ipcrest in London, almost buried in Berlin.
Where are you going now?
Helsinki.
Now, Harry goes to Helsinki. Temperature, ice cold. Prospects, red hot. Mission, destroy the brain before the brain destroys the world.
It do? Tell fortunes?
It makes fortunes. Ours.
Carl Malden as Leo Newbegin, a smooth operator. She's Francoise Dorliac, and she knows just what she's about.
Who ordered you to kill me?
I had to do it. It was an order from the brain.
Get out!
No!
thinks better. The brain talks better. This is where the billion-dollar brain lives, where the people who feed it play, where the man who pays for its keep rules. This is the Russian Harry Palmer met in Berlin.
English, how good to see you.
It's the first time I've ever had a Russian spy on room service.
The Brain versus Kane. Michael Kane.
My brain says the hour is at hand, and my brain is never wrong. I love my country, and my dream is to make the thing I love strong. Strong! Strong!
That's the trailer for Billion Dollar Brain, the 1967 sequel to The Impress File and Funeral in Berlin. By the way, the computer voice that you hear at the start is actually Donald Sutherland, who has a small role in the film, which it's kind of interesting. He was working in England at the time, and he did a lot of episodic television, particularly spy TV shows, in the 1960s. But to move along, the movie was originally going to be directed by André de Toth, who ended up being one of the producers. But he broke his neck a bit skiing, and so he recommended Ken Russell, which was a bit of a bold move, because the only previous feature film that Ken Russell directed was a comedy in 1964, starring James Booth, Roy Kinnear and Marissa Mell, called French Dressing, which I've seen, and it is a bit silly and fun, and set by the seaside, but it's not the sort of thing that would bring you to his mind as the director of a large budget spy movie. He'd also made his reputation doing a lot of television documentaries. He did one about Frederick Delius, did another one about Isadora Duncan, about Debussy and Bartok and composers and all sorts of things like that. He did a short documentary about Antonio Gaudi, for instance. So he was, and another one about traction engines. So he really didn't come to mind as the guy to do a large budget spy movie in the 1960s. But I kind of like the fact that he did. There are bits of it that are kind of Ken Russell inspired madness, but for the most part, it does play very well as a straight spy movie. A lot of people think it's the lesser of the three movies that Michael Caine did as Harry Palmer in the 1960s, but it's right up there with Impress File for me, because I like the arc of it, I like the madness of it, and I like the fact that it goes to unusual locations. But you, again, comparing the series to the James Bond series, where James Bond predominantly, particularly in the earlier films, went to tropical locations, Harry Palmer goes from London, where he is in the start of the third movie, a fairly unsuccessful private investigator running his own agency called the HP Agency, which is a kind of a bit of a pun about HP sauce, which is a condiment in England. And he suddenly gets a deal from the computer voice you heard at the start of the clips I played, where he gets offered £200 to take a package to Helsinki. The package is a thermos flask, and in the thermos flask, which he finds out by a very interesting means, are six eggs. The eggs are actually laden with viruses, and eggs were a way of transporting viruses at the time. And these dodgy viruses are, it says in the movie, from Porton Down, where the English had a biological research station. That's not actually true, because the research station wasn't at Porton Down. It was near Porton Down at Winterbourne Gunner. But I think that may have been an official secret at the time. So they did call it Porton Down, just as a kind of portmanteau term for that kind of biological weapons research stuff. So Harry goes to Helsinki. He doesn't have clothing for the weather and ends up making a call to his contact from a phone box on a frozen landscape. And his contact is a lady called Anya, played by the delicious and delightful Francoise Dauliac, who was the sister of Catherine Deneuve. She died in a car accident, not Catherine Deneuve, but Francoise Dauliac, in a car accident 4 months before the movie was released, after principal photography had completed, which is very sad. I liked her. In fact, I find her in some odd way more attractive than Catherine Deneuve. And in her character of Anya, who is involved with the main bad guys of the film, the character played by Kyle Maud and Leo Newbegin, who works for an insane oil billionaire in America called General Midwinter, played by Ed Begley Sr. And Ed Begley Sr. in this movie is as mad as a cut snake. He is more mad than a Texas governor. He's a very slightly more plausible version of General Jack D. Ripper from Dr. Strangelove. He believes that communists are trying to take over and that he's got to liberate the Soviet Union. And Leo is his contact in Latvia, and they're going to start the invasion in Latvia by freeing Latvia from the Soviet bloc by means of a whole bunch of freedom fighters that General Midwinter is financing in Latvia. Now, what General Midwinter doesn't know is that Leo Newbegin is pocketing the money and has a whole bunch of his relatives in Latvia, basically about 10 or 20 people, who are basically in his employ to continue the con. He's running a con on General Midwinter. And General Midwinter communicates with his network across the world using his computer, his billion-dollar brain, which is a whole bunch of Honeywell 600 terminals hooked up. Now, they're the old-school terminals, you know, the ones with the great big magnetic tape drives and the punch cards that get sorted into slots and things like that. It's all that kind of 1960s atom punk kind of technology, but it looks like General Midwinter has created a very sophisticated computer. He could probably take over the world with it without invading Latvia if he had any brain, which unfortunately General Midwinter doesn't. General Midwinter is totally crazy and doesn't listen to anything that gets in the way of this dream he has of liberating the world from communism. Of course, we're at 2015. General Midwinter could probably run the whole operation off an iPad Air. But this is 1960s computer technology. At the start, when you hear Harry talking to the computer, he doesn't realize that he's talking to a computer because people just simply didn't talk to computers at the time. And that's a very kind of freaky thing. There are technologies in this movie that are very kind of crude and rough that we're now really familiar with. On a daily basis, people talk to Siri, which is in the sense talking to a computer, and yet this appears in a 1967 movie, which is kind of science fictional for the time as well. It can be conceived as a science fiction movie in some slightly lateral kind of way. And, of course, Harry and his old boss, Colonel Ross, hook up again together. Colonel Ross gets him back on board because he can rehire him whenever he likes, even though he has gone private enterprise. And then we get another character from Funeral in Berlin, which I haven't mentioned yet in this podcast, but who's one of the most delightful characters in the movie series. And that is KGB Colonel Stock, the opposite number of Colonel Ross, played with over-the-top enthusiasm by Oscar Homolka. Homolka's a really interesting actor, too. He was Austrian. He was from Vienna. And he left Austria in the 1930s because his wife was Jewish, and he later went on to have a long career as a character actor in Europe and America. He was probably the early role I remember him best for, and it's a serious role rather than a slightly over-the-top comedic role for which he was later known, was playing a saboteur and an anarchist in the 1936 Alfred Hitchcock movie Sabotage. He's in that. But as Colonel Stock, he's a lot of fun. He's a kind of voice of wisdom in a sense. He kind of knows what's going on. He knows more than he suggests. He has a great fondness for Harry Palmer, whom he'd had a favour done by Harry in Funeral in Berlin. And he kind of plays the game of spies in a very interesting but even-handed way. He's looking after the motherland and the Soviet Union, but he realizes that he has to tread carefully and realizes that there's a rapport between himself and Harry Palmer, and that their goals are not mutually antagonistic. In this sense, Harry Palmer and Colonel Stock, and Colonel Ross by implication, are working on the same side. And the enemy in this case is an over-enthusiastic American privatized military, which kind of gives it an interesting spin. You remember, this is when Vietnam was going on. And so there's a little bit of a subtext there that American militarism and American nationalism and American anti-communism is as much a threat to the world as the Soviet aggression. And that kind of takes the spy movie in an interesting direction. Now, the spy movies of the 1960s are at an interesting junction point anyway, because detente is starting. The 1950s were the anti-communist madness of McCarthyism and the Bay of Pigs, leading up to the Bay of Pigs and the unsuccessful invasion of Cuba that represented. But in the 1960s, it was all detente, which is the reason why Spectre took over from Schmersch in the James Bond movies, because there was an increasing kind of engagement with Russia as a diplomatic approach to stopping nuclear war, which meant that you couldn't quite demonize the Russians and the Soviet Union in particular the way you could in the 1950s. So Colonel Stock is actually working on the side of England and on the side of peace, and he's trying to, as much as Harry Palmer and Colonel Ross are, to avoid a nuclear war, which would be inevitably triggered should General Midwinter successfully invade Latvia, or even unsuccessfully invade Latvia. So General Midwinter has this plan. It's a bit based on garbage in, garbage out. The information that Leon Neubegin is giving the Billion Dollar Brain about how things are in Latvia is totally inaccurate, because Leo's skimming the money off it and making a fortune for himself. Now, the plan that General Midwinter has is to use the viruses to weaken the Soviet military in Latvia by spreading the virus around, and they all start coughing up their lungs and dying en masse. And then what General Midwinter thinks is that when his people invade Latvia, the Latvians are going to rise up and overthrow the Soviet regime, and that sees foothold in that part of the world, and that will inevitably lead to a reverse domino theory of the Soviet satellite countries falling. Doesn't happen like that. The plan that General Midwinter has is really, really dumb. It involves an invasion of Latvia across the frozen sea in a convoy of trucks and half tanks, which doesn't quite end the way that he'd like it to. So here's Harry Palmer stuck in the middle of this madness. And it's a hard role for Michael Caine in this movie, because you've got Colonel Stock and Oscar Michael playing over the top. You've got Ed Begley Jr. playing over the top. And you've also got, to a certain extent, Carl Malden as Leo Neubegin playing slightly over the top. And then you've got this weird romance between Anya, played by Françoise Dorliac, and Harry Palmer, and her conflicting loyalties playing out right in the middle of it. So, yeah, it's a slightly odd film in that sense. But it has just enough of that crazy Ken Russell-ness about it to make it really interesting. Of course, what I've mentioned this before in the podcast, and the music of this film I love. Richard Rodney Bennett's music for Billion Dollar Brain is one of my favourite soundtracks in a lot of ways. It's very unusual and very kind of strange and very dissonant. Now, I'm kind of paraphrasing from the Wikipedia page here. It says, to create a relentless, harsh mood, Richard Rodney Bennett left out sweet-sounding instruments like violins and flutes and relied mainly on brass and percussion, including three pianos, which are featured prominently in the main theme. And he uses an early electronic instrument called an Ondes Martinal, which is a really strange... just kind of look at the Wikipedia page for that, because I've got my curiosity up about the Ondes Martinal. And it kind of looks a little bit like a theremin cross with a Hammond organ. It was invented in 1928. An electronic instrument invented in 1928 is a strange and wonderful thing. But just drifting away from it, I think that the Richard Rodney Better soundtrack for this is great. It's at least as good as the more traditional kind of soundtrack that he does for Murder on the Orient Express about a decade later. Nonetheless, I like this movie for a lot of reasons. I like the continuation of Harry Palmer's story. I like the General Midwinter's crusade to save the world from communism. Ed Begley Sr., got to remember, this isn't Ed Begley Jr., this is Ed Begley Sr., is frighteningly over the top as General Midwinter, with and a lot of his stuff really does include some kind of Nazi iconography almost. In one of the crusades he has at his enormous ranch in Texas where the billion-dollar brain lives in an underground vault. The movie's got a touch of James Bond there. It's kind of where Harry Palmer and James Bond cross over. You've got a mad general with scientific weaponry, in this case a computer. You've got a plan to conquer the world. You've got a threat to the world, which exists very strongly in this film, and it's something that's carried over very weakly in Bullet to Beijing in a very kind of watered-down and low-budget kind of way. But this is Harry Palmer saving the world, in a sense, with the aid, of course, of Colonel Stock and several other players. But just to wrap up Billion Dollar Brain, I love the 1960s style of it. I love the Finnish furniture and the locations in Finland and the places Harry goes to. I love Colonel Stock. One of my favourite characters in spy movies is Oscar Homolka's Colonel Stock. He is particularly good in a scene that takes place at a concert where he describes how a particular piece of music makes him feel. And there's that kind of character detail in there, which is kind of not entirely necessary to the film, but just adds that little bit extra to it in a lot of ways. I haven't read the all of the book Billion Dollar Brain. I've just started reading Len Deighton's original novel, and of course this, the Harry Palmer series is based on books by Len Deighton, and I'm enjoying what I've read so far, but then I got distracted by another book and so I've stopped reading Billion Dollar Brain, but I'm going to go back to it and finish it up just so I can say that I've done it, in a sense. And I do enjoy Len Deighton's spy fiction. It's very un-Ian Fleming and very un-Jean Le Carré. But that's about it for Billion Dollar Brain. Like I said, don't bother seeing Midnight in St. Petersburg and Bullet to Beijing unless you absolutely have to. It's not a good continuation of the series. But these three movies kind of do all offer an alternative to James Bond films in the 1960s. And they show show Michael Caine at the start of his stardom. This movie came out a year after he played one of the main characters in Zulu, Cy Enfield's movie about the Maasai Wars in South Africa. And this comes just before the real breakout role. This is one of two breakout roles that Michael Caine had. The other one being Alfie, about a year later, where he really became one of the biggest stars around for a period of time. He did do some really shit movies at the time, too. He has a history of doing good movies and shit movies back-to-back almost. A thing called Hurry Sundown, a Southern Gothic kind of thing he did for Otto Preminger in 1967, where he plays a Southern plantation owner who's married to Jane Fonda. Doesn't work well because his accent's all over the place. He can't really do American accents. If you want to have a really bad movie night, I recommend Hurry Sundown. But anyway, to get back on track, the Harry Palmer trilogy, classic 1960s spy stuff, love it all. I've actually got the Ipcress File Day Bill poster, movie poster, the Australian one, which has kind of got some crude artwork on it, but I really like it. And I'm increasingly trying to get, at reasonable prices, 1960s spy movie posters. Not necessarily the James Bond ones, because they run several hundred dollars each, even in the Day Bill form. But kind of other spy movies I'm picking up bits and pieces of now and then. And I kind of like having a little bit of a collection of those. But anyway, that's about it for the podcast. I'm going to do the credits. Now, I haven't redone the credit track for the extra people we have on the podcast. We have our donut wrangler Tamora. And we also have our unnamed credit, which is for Tim Levy. But I'll leave you with the rest of the credits now. If you want to support the podcast with a micropayment, please do by going to patreon.com/paleocinema. I'll be back in a week with another Martian Drive-In podcast. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another Paleocinema podcast where I'm going to do one of the movies that one of the Patreon subscribers has recommended for me. But anyway, look after yourselves in the meantime. Take care. If you're American, go and see Age of Ultron because you know you want to. If you're Australian, you're already seen it a couple of weeks ago. And I think that Manny Pacquiao was ripped off in the fight. I'll catch you guys later. Here are the credits. And here are the podcast credits in the style of movie credits. So thank you to all of the Patreon campaign subscribers who are put a couple of bucks in and help out the podcast. First off, I'm going to go to this at random. So first off, we have Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris the Musical Director, Jan the Dialect Coach, Armin the Key Grip, Matt the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine the Scientific Advisor, Julia, the casting director, Chris, the camera operator, Christopher, the gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, the foley artist, Alyssa, the location scout, Mark, the second unit director, and Paul, the special makeup effects director. So thank you very much to all of the supporters of the podcast. You help this out a lot, and it really is appreciated. And of course, as usual, thank you to Mr. Claude Debussy for playing the music.